content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. And our first article today is Why I Write Children's Books, written by Paul O'Donnell. Since childhood, I've been a regular target of ignorance and bigotry. My experience contributed to my becoming a scholar of history and religion. But more than that, it has given me a clearer view of how identity can fuel belonging or isolation. Now that I'm a father to two young girls, disrupting bias and encouraging empathy feels urgent and necessary, a personal and professional responsibility. In a world that feels more polarized by the day, how do we disrupt bias and encourage connection? Empathy doesn't just appear on its own. In a large part, it has to be nurtured, and ages 1 to 6 is a prime window. While temperament plays a role, so does a child's environment, including the people and stories they're exposed to. There aren't many children's books centered on Sikh characters or on Sikh American life, so I decided to write some myself, a move that made at least one scholarly colleague raise an eyebrow. A grand plan? Yes. But it's my belief, my hope, my conviction that picture books can change the world. Signs of empathy appear in the first year or two of life when infants may cry in response to another person's distress. By age 3, this emotional responsiveness is joined by cognitive empathy, or the ability to accurately imagine another person's experience. The ability to feel for another person likely comes from specific brain cells that automatically and unconsciously mirror others' emotions as our own. Evidence of empathy in young kids, spontaneous helping or sharing, is correlated with prosocial behaviors in adulthood. Establishing these empathetic pathways early in life matters. It can be hard to make up ground if you miss the window. Practicing empathy is wholly dependent on being exposed to other people's feelings. This happens through socialization, with parents, siblings, friends, and also through stories. A groundbreaking 2006 study in the Journal of Research in Personality found that the tendency to become absorbed in a story was associated with greater empathy and social ability. Another study demonstrated that fiction, especially narratives that transport readers out of their own world, influences readers' capacity for understanding. Picture books, specifically, help little kids navigate their big emotions, while at the same time fostering an ability to see the world through someone else's eyes. I distinctly remember experiencing this as a child when I read The Snowy Day, a book about a black boy very different from me, living everyday life and finding joy. If stories help kids develop empathy and connect with others, then the questions become, whose stories are my kids, are all American kids, exposed to? Whose feelings and experiences do they have a chance to connect with, and what values are they learning from them? In recent years, children's literature has become increasingly diverse, involving a multiplicity of voices and perspectives. Our kids now have more points of connection. The Cooperative Children's Book Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison reports that in 2024, 51% of almost 3,500 children's and young adult books featured significant content related to people of color. 13% featured Asian characters. These proportions reflect the U.S. population fairly well, which is a good indication of the progress we've made over the past few decades. Still, raising your kids as part of a minority, especially one that faces misrepresentation in the media, can feel isolating. I began writing children's books as a way to share my Sikh traditions so they could be seen and accepted for what they are. I've long felt that storybooks engage in more complex concepts and emotions than books for older kids. They're capricious and visual enough to explore big, wild ideas, yet narrow enough to be digestible and pragmatic. I took inspiration from so many children's books authors, especially Vashti Harrison, the author illustrated behind the books Hair Love, Big, and others. A Vashti to Remember by Simranjit Singh. Storybooks expand representation by honoring the cultural and subjective nuances of identity, helping us see both ourselves and one another more clearly. My first picture book, Faju Singh Keeps Going, tells the true story of the oldest person ever to run a marathon, a tale that challenged my assumptions about what a hero could look like, living with disability, elderly, unable to read, an immigrant. My latest, A Vashti to Remember, centers on a harvest holiday among Punjabi farmers that has evolved into the most significant celebration in the Sikh tradition. It traces the migration of a girl from her village in Punjab to a city in North America. Her search for belonging is at once personal and universal. It's uncomfortable to change schools, or to move to a new house, or to immigrate. I intentionally left Punjabi phrases and terms untranslated, a wink to my Sikh and Punjabi readers, and I see you, that can mean so much for people who live on the margins of society and often feel invisible. But picture books, even ones about Sikh children's, aren't only to provide a sense of belonging. When Sesame Workshop compiled its 2024 State of Well-Being Report, 84% of Americans and 93% of educators said that having a more kindness-focused characters in children's media is important in helping kids be more kind. As a children's book author, I also want to create a point of connection that serves as the first step toward compassion. Picture books help kids learn that difference isn't scary or even all that unusual. It's an utterly human fact that they will encounter every day. What if, instead of being fearful, children could embrace differences with the openness and curiosity that seems to come so naturally to them? When kids are given the opportunity to practice feeling for others early and often, it can help build the more compassionate world I hope my children and all of our children will inherit. Our second story, Jewish musicians mourn Gaza's suffering in Yiddish, a language nearly lost to genocide. This is written by Dina Prechep. In the first few days after Hamas's brutal attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, New York artist Joe Dobkin was scrolling through news coverage when he saw a video of an Israeli soldier on a tank rolling into Gaza. The soldier was singing an old Yiddish song. The song was Zag Nit Kimmel, also known as the Partisan Hymn, inspired by the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I saw this and I got the message that what this Israeli soldier was doing is for the survival of the Jewish people. This is for me, this is for my family, said Dobkin, and this is while all day, every day, I'm watching images come across my social media feeds of people being bombed to death. Dobkin is the grandchild of Holocaust survivors and the descendant of people who didn't survive, so he wanted to respond in Yiddish, speaking out about what he saw as genocide in this language that was almost destroyed by one. I needed something to counter it, Dobkin explained, and the thing that I wanted was also in Yiddish. Nearly 2 years later, with the Gaza Health Ministry reporting that more than 63,000 Palestinians dead and unfolding famine in Gaza, Dobkin has released Lieder mit Palestine, Songs with Palestine, New Yiddish Songs of Grief, Fury, and Love, a fundraising album that uses the historic language of European Jews to mourn Palestinian suffering. The idea for the album began with a song Dobkin wrote in Yiddish. There is no safety through oppression, not with occupation or high walls. The past must not become a prison, but instead an instrument of liberation. How does a prayer sound? What does family mean? Who has the right to grow old at home? After conversations with fellow Yiddish singers Josh Waletsky and Isabel Fry, the group sent out a call for similar songs, writing, in the midst of the ongoing nightmare in Palestine, inflicted allegedly on our behalf as Jews, we are moved, as inheritors and practitioners of a peoplehood and culture that was threatened with obliteration, to proclaim our commitment to a future liberation for all people. The resulting album was released in July and features 17 original compositions from different musicians, some modern, some mournful, and all shaped by Yiddish and its history, like a poem by Sholem Berger, sung by Esther Gottesman, that when translated reads, their death will not revive the dead, their hunger is not our bread. Multiplying their tears will only mean more tears. Blood is red. It's not surprising that so many in the Yiddish community felt called to respond to Israel's actions in Gaza, said Madeline Cohn, who directs educational programs at the Yiddish Book Center and teaches Jewish studies at Mount Holyoke College. For every generation that comes to Yiddish, there is this feeling of urgency, a feeling of responsibility, because of the violent ruptures of the 20th century, said Cohen. Because of genocide, displacement, and assimilation, a surprisingly small number of Jews outside of Orthodox Judaism grow up speaking Yiddish. Some are drawn to Yiddish because of its history as a language of leftist socialist causes, versus the embrace of Hebrew as the language of Zionism, and some for its rich cultural tradition. But all who choose Yiddish feel the weight of its story, says Fry, who is an ethnomusicologist as well as a Yiddish musician. Singing in Yiddish about what is happening in Gaza is automatically putting into relation the Holocaust and whatever is happening there, said Fry. It's something that opens up a space for acknowledging the pain of the other and seeing it in relation to one's own trauma and pain. And I think that's actually something very powerful. Fry, who helped produce the album along with Dobkin and Waletsky, pointed out powerful lyrics in the album's contributions. She said that one song by Waletsky is based on this Yiddish idiom, the person that digs a grave for others falls in themselves. The lyrics, translated from Yiddish by Fry, say, you keep digging and digging a deep grave, and you keep thinking it's for them. We're standing at the crossroads between humanity and the abyss, and it's tearing out a piece of my heart. I mean, that's how I've been feeling every day, Fry added. To build the world of Yiddish culture is to work in the shadow of loss and destruction, and also music and joy. The Yiddish community, like pretty much every Jewish community, has been torn by what's happened on and since October 7th. But the musicians on Lieder mit Palestine are hoping they can use this old language to bring a new perspective. This story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Services. Our third story. After Annunciation shooting, Catholic schools pray, prepare drills in sanctuaries. This was written by Alesia Hetzler McCain. As news of a mass shooting at a welcome back mass for the Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis spread across the country on August 27th, Catholic educators and church leaders sprang into action, reinforcing safety protocols and counseling students, even as they worked to process their own emotions about an unprecedented tragedy in which two children were killed and an additional 18 people were injured. While many school leaders have become resigned to the necessity of preparing for potential school shootings, it was shocking to Catholics across the country to learn of an attack as students were gathered for worship. Paul Escala, superintendent of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, more than 250 Catholic schools, said school leaders oftentimes assume that it's going to be someone inside the school campus coming in through corridors. This case was unimaginable, he said, that you have an active shooter beginning their shooting on the outside of the church through the glass, which was low and close to the pews. The unaccustomed situation of a school shooting occurring at a church has prompted the Archdiocese of Los Angeles and Chicago to reinforce school safety plans to ensure their planning covers the time students spend at parish churches. Karen Rebhan-Suk, deputy superintendent of the school support, said that the Archdiocese of Chicago's more than 150 schools will now be practicing active shooter drills in churches. We've been very explicit with our schools and our churches that they need to now consider, if they haven't before, the sanctuary as an area that could also be at risk, said Escala. Both Escala and Rebhan-Suk said their safety teams have been in contact with the FBI. Rebhan-Suk added that their leadership is also learning from the Minneapolis Police Department. Escala said Catholic schools are at an escalated threat level right now because of the potential for copycat attacks. We always consider the possibility that this might have been directed at our faith and not necessarily just at Annunciation School. Despite security measures such as cameras, security guards, door protection, window protection, Escala said, this darkness finds its way in. The superintendent said, sadly, people will find a way if they are determined. In Chicago, Rebhan-Suk said school officials are looking for opportunities to improve their standardized emergency operation plan, which was developed this June at a symposium run jointly by the Department of Homeland Security and Illinois Police, and replaced plans that the Archdiocese schools had developed on their own. Learning about the shooting at Annunciation, even with all of the sadness that has brought, has reinforced the importance of safety plans, because it seems like the school's basic safety steps, such as locking the church's doors, likely saved lives, Rabban Suk said. But even as they tweaked safety plans, Catholic schools were also working to support students and staff by gathering in prayer. We can worship with due care and safety, but we will worship nonetheless because we will not allow anyone to take that away from us. And that is where we seek our power, our refuge, and our security, said Escala. Fear is not an option. The LA school superintendent called the shooting an attempt to silence our prayer, to silence our faith, to silence our children. But he said he was determined that Catholics will fill the void of darkness and loss with the light of love and compassion, including for the shooter. We are going to do a better job of reaching out to those who may have been hurt for whatever reason, may have lost their faith and their ability to reconcile the pain that they may have in their heart, Escala said, wondering aloud what the shooter might have been going through. In focusing on students' psychological needs, Rabban Suk said Chicago Catholic schools have particularly leaned on the National Association of School Psychologists when working to speak with children about gun violence in developmentally appropriate ways. They also have a mental health support line available that is staffed by a social worker and the Archdiocese Director of Social-Emotional Learning, in addition to the counselors at many schools. The social-emotional support is so important when students are in trouble or students are hurting, said Rabban Suk. San Antonio Archbishop Gustavo Garcia Siller, who witnessed a similar aftermath in Uvalde, told Religion News Service he screamed spontaneously when he heard the news from Minnesota. After the May 2022 shooting at Robb Elementary School in his diocese, Garcia Siller immediately provided pastoral care, visiting students in the hospital and consoling parents and the children of a slain teacher, and held nightly masses. But the impact on the Annunciation community will likely be long-lasting, he said, as they have been in Uvalde, where Teresan sisters still make daily visits throughout the community. A counseling center on site at the parish opened last fall. But Garcia Siller said Texas political leaders still have not fulfilled the basic needs of Uvalde's low-income community, including for health care and psychological support. It's like nothing happened, even though we remember, he said. To remember them on the anniversary, that's nice, but it's a token. They need to see changes in their place, the quality of life. The San Antonio Archbishop thinks it's still possible that many in the Annunciation community will be too afraid to go back to the church building, just as some students felt about Robb Elementary. He emphasized the importance of prayer right now to prevent people from losing their faith in God, in community, in themselves. He has sent Archbishop Bernard Hebda a letter expressing his sympathy. When asked about his advice for the Twin Cities Archbishop, Garcia Siller expressed admiration for Hebda's leadership skills, said that, in his experience, being present, listening, expressing the church's support, and connecting victims to resources was most helpful in Uvalde. Garcia Siller was just one of several Catholic bishops to renew his calls for gun control measures in response to the Annunciation shooting. We cannot just let these stories continue piling up, he said. People are being killed, all ages and all over. The U.S. must address hatred and division, he added, saying, we need to be more careful what we say, how we express ourselves, how we build bridges, and how we promote and foster pieces of peace and common tranquility. The Annunciation shooting came one day after another shooting outside Cristo Rey Jesuit High School, also in Minneapolis, where a man died. Local officials do not believe the two shootings are linked and have not said that anyone related to the school was involved or targeted by the shooting. The Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis did not make a school official available for an interview, and the Reverend Thomas Bambrick, the director of Jesuit Mission and Identity at Cristo Rey, said he was declining interviews and focusing on supporting our school community during this time. In Los Angeles, Escala said he believed better relationships could help protect the community from violence. We have the power to overcome these incredibly devastating moments if we are willing to make the sacrifices necessary to put aside our own personal needs to truly engage one another in dialogue and resolution in conflict, he said. As a leader, he underlined the value of listening. People need to cathartically share their feelings, he said. We need institutional leadership to assume the defensive position that we need to have an answer for everything, and sometimes there are no answers. That listening draws on the Catholic Church's theological focus on synodality, or dialogue and walking together. By focusing on synodality and the Jubilee year, as Scala said, Catholics can, quote, take this moment that is indeed horrible and turn it into a moment of resurrection, end quote. After the Minneapolis shooting, security firms see an influx of interest from faith groups. This story was written by Jack Jenkins. When Nick Spencer heard about the shooting that took place last week at a Catholic church in Minneapolis, he, like millions of Americans, was heartbroken. But as the chief operations officer of the security firm Strategos International, he also prepared for what he knew would come next. Unfortunately, once an event occurs, there's a huge inquiry that happens. People want to know about resources. What can we do to not be the next victim in this situation? According to Spencer, demand for Strategos' services has grown as mass shootings at houses of worship continue to make headlines. Putting ballistic film on windows, installing security cameras, and fortifying doors with locks are mentioned by multiple security companies as steps to take. Even so, faith leaders say hardening houses of worship isn't the only way to keep the worshipers safe, or for many, even their preferred method. Many houses of worship ban guns on their properties, and religious groups have been among the loudest calling for gun control legislation. I had to cut off that last story because we've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.